This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to the special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal and I'm joined today by Kate Andrews and Michael Gove. And today is a sort of mixed day, isn't it, Kate? Because you are leaving us but not leaving us. You're going from being the economics editor here in London to instead becoming the US deputy editor.
It's true, James, and it's very, very emotional. Very happy, sad. I've been thinking about returning to the States for some time. It's where I'm from. I feel very American. And as a journalist, there are so many exciting things going on over there, good and bad. I feel incredibly privileged to have this opportunity to go with The Spectator. It's also been 5 years here at The Spectator mothership in the UK, an experience that has fundamentally changed my life. I could gush for hours, but I've been so lucky to have the best colleagues, the best experiences, the best editors who really whip my writing into shape. I've never learned more. I've never had more fun. And what a time the past 5 years to be at an institution like The Spectator. But yes, I'm not leaving per se. I hope, you know, I've got our producer, Cindy, next to me. If she's so kind, maybe she'll still let my voice on the podcast. She's making a bad face. It doesn't bode well for me, but it will be different. I can't pretend it won't be different.
And one of the things you can do when you're in America, perhaps, is make the case for free trade with President Trump. And that is today's Saturday Shots,
which is transition.
The difference, because we have, I'm delighted to say, a conservative and a liberal together and talking perhaps about the reasons why my editor, Michael Gove, is a conservative and my colleague, Kayla, is a liberal. So, Michael, perhaps you first of all, what is the difference between conservatism and liberalism and why are you a conservative?
Well, the first thing I should say is a huge thank you to Kate. Kate is the US Marine Corps of journalism. She was deployed 5 years ago when I was in government as a conservative and as a quite authoritarian conservative at the heart of lockdown imposition. And Kate, as a liberal, was fighting for freedom against the government at that time. And now Kate is going to the US. She's being redeployed, helivacked out and on the front line there. And she'll be fighting for free markets, free trade, freedom of speech, Spectator values, with one exception, in a moment, in the United States. And it's great that Kate will be there. For all the reasons that we know, America and the decisions that the president are making are reshaping our world. And there is no one better to interpret that, both to an American audience and to a British audience, than Kate, with her mix of economic expertise, journalistic flair, and high principle. Talking of principles, I think the key difference, and you know, the word liberal has a different meaning in America. It just generally means left. But Kate, unless she corrects me, is a proper classical liberal.
Yes, in the English sense.
In the English sense, she is a proper Gladstonian, a proper Hayekian, a proper Friedmanite, someone who believes that the state should know its limits, that personal freedom and human flourishing go together. I, as a conservative, respect that. That's part of the conservative tradition. But one of the reasons why I'm a conservative, not a liberal, is I have a slightly more pessimistic view of human nature. And also I envisage a slightly bigger role for institutions, government, the state, and tradition. And one of the joys of The Spectator is that as a magazine, it's not wholly conservative and it's not wholly liberal. It's got both traditions as part of the conversation that The Spectator has with its readers.
I mean, Kate, surely there's a tension there, obviously, between the conservatives and liberalism as well in your view set. And why do you come down more on the liberal side than the conservative side?
I'll come on to that. But the first thing I want to say is I'm so pleased that we picked this topic, Michael, because while we may tease out some differences between the conservatives and the liberals, there are many, we have something in common. I am incredibly pessimistic. especially when it comes to human nature. I am not the optimist that, say, John Locke was, or even perhaps Adam Smith was, that if you just allow people to do as they please and to live their lives, everything turns out perfectly. No, no, I'm much more skeptical of the way that humans treat one another. I'm not Hobbesian. Actually, perhaps I am, because he's often misunderstood. Hobbes did not say that everybody was evil. He said that we were all very self-interested, and I think that is exactly right. One of the reasons that I am classically liberal is because whilst I recognize the challenge of man living next to man, I'm also very well aware of the problems that come when man lives under man, when you give people disproportionate power over others. I think you see that liberty is often rationed. I think you see that people are treated as second-tier citizens. I think you see rights taken away. So we come from a very similar perspective on this. Ahead of this podcast, I decided to return to Friedrich Hayek's Why I Am Not a Conservative essay. He said it better than I'm ever going to be able to. But I think what's so great about that essay is that really he's trying to define the difference between a liberal and a conservative. And Michael touched on it there, and I think it's right that the conservative is much more closely wedded to the idea of certain institutions and much more hesitant of change. And where the conservatives and the liberals have almost always been united is against the progressives and the socialists, because they don't want that kind of change. The liberals don't want it, the conservatives don't want it. But the liberal is slightly more open-minded to the idea of change, and change happening very fast if it fits with their principles. And I think that probably is where I sit. I look at the success of free market economies over a quarter of a century, and a very unique period of time in which free market conservatism in many of these countries was able to thrive. And you see a billion people being lifted out of poverty. You see standards of living go up across the board in every single income bracket. You see freedom of speech. You see right to bodily autonomy. You see practically every standard for freedom, personal and economic, increase. And I do believe that that is a better world to live in. Do I think there are trade-offs? Yes. And do I think there's a role for the state? Absolutely. I'm no anarchist. I think one of the frustrations I've had with small C conservative governments and capital C conservative, successive conservative governments, certainly in the UK, is I think they've often actually forgot about the vital roles of the state, what it's meant to do, national defense, to really support those who cannot support themselves, to make that safety net actually quite decent for those who could otherwise not prop themselves up. I think that there's a vital role for the state and a vital role for conservative ideology. But personally, when I see fast change move in the favor of making us freer and better off, I don't shudder. I'm not opposed to it. I'm actually very gung-ho about it. And I suppose that's why I fall in the liberal camp.
And again, there's a lot in what Kate says that that I instinctively agree with. So there are shades and I think nuances where there are differences, in which I think would come from a conservative point of view or a conservative tradition. So I think that liberty tends to be rooted in institutions and in culture. So I think that you can describe freedoms in a relatively abstract way, a Locke, Mill, Bentham fashion. And I note that Kate says that she's not quite in that space, absolutely. But I tend to think that freedoms are recognised in the particular political cultures that have grown up over time, where there's an acceptance that there are institutions like the rule of law and like a respect for ancestral wisdom that restrain the temper of the times. So one of the things about Edmund Burke, one of my heroes, is he says that individuals do not trade upon their own private stock of reason, that no one emerges into a political conversation, as it were, without having to pay attention, even if they choose to reject what has happened in the past, the lessons of previous generations, what they can tell us about prudence and the limits of human agency and action. The second thing related to that, and I'd be very interested in Kate's views on this, is that in the debates around the creation, the foundation of the American Republic, I sense that there was also a tension there between the genuinely more liberal view of Thomas Jefferson, who believed in states' rights and who was a, you know, a naturally, as I say, small and large liberal, and Alexander Hamilton, who believed that it was more important for the federal government, whether that was through tariffs or industrial policy or through the creation of a, you know, the Federal Reserve, to ensure that there were strong state institutions for the infant republic. And now, if I'd been around at the time, I would definitely have been a Hamiltonian. But I don't know if Kate would have been a Jeffersonian. I suspect so.
I suspect I would have been too, particularly from those fundamental philosophical points that you bring up there, Michael. But again, you can understand where Hamilton was coming from. Of course you can. And the liberals, to some extent, did. They built that country together. Yes, they fiercely debated each other. And I think they roughly fell on the right side of the lines, which is that states to this day are still, in many cases, more powerful than the federal government. But that does not mean that federal power does not exist. But I think this is also an important point for the liberals, is that those institutions that Michael talks about are vital. I mean, I don't reject them, and I don't reject the history that has proven them by any means. But you also must be able to be critical of them, because we see what happens when you're not. What Elon Musk is doing right now with Doge, going through federal government spending and recognizing how this has got completely out of control. What is not happening in the UK, which would potentially be an audit of our National Health Service and going through institutions that for decades have not been able to be touched because of the almost religious status that they have taken on. I think that is a danger, and it's one that conservatives, I think, need to challenge slightly more, in the same way that the liberals often, in the same way that the liberals absolutely risk being too critical of what has come before and not recognizing that there might be a reason for it. I do think that appreciating institutions for institutions' sake means that you end up with a failing health service. You end up with a bloated bureaucracy.
Yeah, of course, I mean, no one wants to venerate sort of outdated institutions, of course. But I mean,
say that, James, but I mean, the Tories and the Labour Party were literally praying to it last summer in Westminster Cathedral, the NHS for its 75-year anniversary. I think there definitely is a sense that outdated institutions are still revered.
But isn't there a sense perhaps that, you know, we're working with the grain of human nature here, and that actually conservatism is something that, you know, is something that appeals to people. There's much more, people have a romantic attraction to it and a pragmatic appeal. And actually, it's better to work with the grain of human nature rather than against, with this sort of liberalism, which actually, you know, frankly, when it's put untrammeled, and for instance, it was tried in the Eastern Europe in the 1990s, can often produce counterproductive results and lead to a swing to totalitarianism.
Well, I think that humans naturally fall somewhere between conservatism and liberalism, to be frank. I think the idea of community, the idea of religion, organized religion, and the idea of some of those core institutions is very much what makes people feel safe. It makes them feel secure, and they crave it. But the only way that you can know that somebody is voluntarily opting into those things, into that community, into that religious space, into that marriage, which is another institution, let's talk about the social ones as well that are vital to society, is if you put the individual first. And this is an accusation that's often made against liberals, is you just want to live in this individualist world. You don't care about what happens to your fellow man, and you think you can thrive that way. Well, no, of course not. Human beings are sociable. We crave companionship. It would be crazy to live in a world where we truly just operated as individuals. But the point I would make is that I know that somebody wants to be in that community. They want to be married to that person. They want to have children. They want this lifestyle. So long as the individual needs and their liberty and their own pursuit of happiness has fundamentally come first, because then I know that they've opted in. They haven't been forced. I have a question for Michael, and I wonder, when we look at America and the UK and the way that we use these words, because as you say, liberal in America means something completely different. How much of this comes down to political parties and to culture? Because there are so many small C conservatives in America who will vote Democrat.
Yes.
Right? And I wonder if part of that is because it's not called the Conservative Party, it's called the Republican Party, it's called the Democrat Party. Here in the UK, the fact that these words are also adopted by political parties, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, they're anything but liberal, especially these days.
Yes.
But all of a sudden, that perhaps does characterize how somebody identifies in terms of their philosophy. I would also note that in America, there's a very, very strong libertarian movement. Elon Musk calls himself a libertarian. They don't exist in the UK. It's a dirty word.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that there's a tendency sometimes, because of the shared language and increasingly shared media institutions like The Spectator US, to believe that the trends and currents are interchangeable. I remember once a Republican friend of mine saying, there are three big parties in the UK, aren't there? There's Labour, they like the Democrats. There are the Liberal Democrats, they like the Liberal Democrats. And there are the Conservatives, who like the Democrats. And It's not to say that British politics is all to the left of where America is, because left and right don't adequately convey it. But you are, I think, absolutely right, Kate, that there are differences there. And there are elements in both Democrat and Republican parties that don't have a direct analogue here. So people draw a parallel between, say, the MAGA tendency and Reform or Brexiteers. And yeah, there are areas of overlap, but there are distinctions. And the, you know, on the one hand, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, the isolationist trend in America is one that it's difficult for the UK fully to understand. We sort of feel, well, America should always be on our side, taking the same position as Britain. You know, that is the historic alliance. Wasn't that why Churchill wrote The History of the English-Speaking Peoples? But for America, its foundation story is, hey, Brits, with, you know, with your monarchy, with your lords, with your arbitrary rule, there's a reason why we left, and there's a reason why we established a separate republic, and there's a reason why we don't want to get involved in your ancestral tangles. And I think, I hope that one of the things that The Spectator can do, and there's no one better equipped than Kate to do it, is to help Brits and Americans better understand each other's politics, particularly when there are differences.
Michael, just two questions for you, one of which is, how did your 14 years in government change you in terms of your philosophical outlook? Did you become more conservative over time? What did you change on that? And the second thing is, you said at the beginning you disagreed on one principle with The Spectator. Which was that one?
So I think I did become more conservative over time during my time in government. And there were two particular phrases that I often used with colleagues, and one of them Kate alluded to earlier. So one of them was Chesterton's fence, famous principle that G.K. Chesterton put forward, that the radical, and there were times in government when I was radical, looks at an existing institution like a fence on the road and says, can't see any reason for it, get rid of it. But there was a reason why someone put it there in the first place. So to take a case in point, I voted very happily with David Cameron and the coalition to reform the House of Lords. I now think, I know it's a terribly crusty position, that that is a waste of energy, and it's an exercise that puts the ideal ahead of the real. The other phrase that I used to the irritation sometimes of some of my colleagues, because it was very pretentious, is the Procrustes bed, the idea that one size should fit all. So again, if you are a reformer, you want to put forward a proposition and say, this is a simple, clear answer to everything, but there will always be anomalies. And so I recognize, for example, that when it came to planning reform, that one had to take account of aesthetic and environmental and other concerns, that the original view that I had way back when I was a housing spokesman in opposition, I'm still in favour of quite radical planning reform, but the original view that I had, sweep all that away, doesn't do justice to human nature. Final point, where do I disagree? Well, I'm probably in a minority, not just in the Spectator office, and not just within the British Conservative family, but in the country, in that I am an instinctive protectionist. I believe that you do need sometimes to place limits on free trade. And the reason for that is I believe that competition between individuals and companies is a good thing, but competition between nations is an ineradicable fact of international relations, and that sometimes you do need to either protect agriculture, protect critical defence sectors, or if you have an aggressive nation like China that's engaging in dumping, protect critical aspects of your industrial base. Now, I recognise that once government says, oh, well, steel is critical, then there is pressure on government to say, well, we want to be protected too. So there is always pressure on government once it embraces something that may be a good expedient in certain circumstances to extend it. But I do think that sometimes that's necessary.
Well, I'm slightly relieved because, Michael, I do think there's hope for you now, given the very specific areas you just laid out. If you had come here and said free trade is just nonsense, let's scrap the whole thing. I guess, suppose as a conservative, you probably wouldn't want to scrap the whole thing simply because we've got some historical evidence that it works. That would have been very concerning. But you've picked out two areas that I think are some of the most nuanced and important to discuss, agriculture and defense. And I suppose one of my frustrations, let's take defense, is that rather than saying, We know that the UK steel industry is not going to be profitable. This is not a serious business in the, you know, classic capitalist sense of it, but we think it's important. We pretend that it is. We pretend that the subsidies and the hundreds of millions of pounds that are going to go into it are for the purpose of having a free market society where we can compete with steel. I would much rather that the UK just say, we're actually going to take this all into the defense budget. We are going to subsidize the heck out of this. We are going to treat it as a critical asset to UK security rather than actually bring it into the free market debate. Similarly with agriculture, I think it's worthwhile to say this is also fundamentally a security and defense issue, what we just saw with COVID. You know, what if that pandemic had been worse? What if it had affected children? What if borders had been shut, not for months, but for years? We have to be able to feed ourselves. I think you'd have to make a lot of different decisions, painful economic decisions as a government to make that case to the public, because at the moment, even if you had very protectionist policy around agriculture, the UK still probably couldn't feed itself. But I think we should move the debate into that territory rather than pretend that it is actually a stain on the broader success story of free trade. If I may, Michael, I want to ask you about this because you mentioned MAGA and Brexit not really comparable. Mm. I could not agree more because MAGA is not very small L liberal, no. Right? It's actually a very big state. Mm. It's very interventionist. It's my way or the highway. If I had to name two policies, two big changes that took place in the 14, almost 15 years of Tory government, I would have said Brexit, the genuine, compelling case to shed a layer of government in the EU and to return sovereignty to the UK. I think it's a very small
and
liberal.
A restoration was what a lot of Brexiteers would say. You know, it wasn't a revolution, it was a restoration.
Indeed, there's a reason that people like Dan Hannan, there's a reason that so many free marketeers were on the side of Brexit. And education reform. The idea that you as the parent, that you as the individual family know what's best for your child and get to choose how they're educated. Michael, those are two very liberal changes. And if I had to associate one person that connected the two, I'm not sure I could do better than to say Michael Gove.
Or Boris Johnson, of course.
No, education reform, well, Michael. I'm sorry. I think it's you.
Boris was a big champion of it. I think you're right. They're both areas where both tendencies coincide. So on the one hand, with education reform, one of the things we were trying to do was small C conservative. We believed that the best that had been thought and written was an inheritance that every child should have access to. But you're right, there very much was a liberal element about disruption and innovation through free schools, about greater autonomy for head teachers and greater choice for parents. So it was a melding of the two. And ditto with Brexit. In some respects, it was a constitutional restoration, as James quite rightly says, saying that the sovereignty of Parliament should be strengthened and that the ceding of power to institutions which were not accountable to the British people should be reversed. But you were also right. Some of the most articulate advocates of Brexit were people who believed in lesser government and who also believed that the sort of corporatist, bureaucratic, therapeutic approach that the Commission was taking towards regulation and legislation was better replaced by something that was lighter, more flexible, and more nimble. So there was a fusion of the two, which again sort of reinforces my instinct that you need to have that conversation.
Well, if I could offer two final reflections, perhaps, I often think that taking from both your traditions, one of the Spectator's great success over the years has been perhaps Tory anarchism, which I think was one of the wars. It was either Oberon or Evelyn who said it. And perhaps that sense of respect to the institutions while completely demeaning the people who are running them is part of our success. And the second thing is the talk of Hobbes. You know, it always makes you think of John Bercow, short, nasty and brutish. And so we are delighted that Kate Andrews' time here at The Spectator has been anything but all those three and has had a long, glorious reign. And I'm sure she'll do fantastic things in America as well.
It's very kind, James. Thank you so much. Thank you, Michael. This has been a fascinating conversation. And I would say that when I was rereading Hayek's Why I'm Not a Conservative, one of his biggest takeaways is that the liberals and the conservatives need each other. And I think that has been teased out here. There's absolutely no doubt that the overlaps are big. And defining it is so interesting because I think Michael and I are both almost, not in every circumstance, trying to take credit for the same principles and the same things. Mm-hmm. And I think that was Hayek's point too. So, you know, and that's maybe a conservative point. We look to our history.
Well, thank you for joining us on Coffee Hour Shots today. And you can tune in on Monday for more Hayek-explosive content.